going to comment on page 15 of our book. Ladies and gentlemen, our group chairman, Hamilton S.
All right, good evening, everybody. My name's Hamilton, and I am an alcoholic. I want to thank everyone for coming. It's a joy to see a lot more than 25 people here. You know, this is tough standing up here in 90-degree weather, I'll tell you right now. I wasn't expecting this, but it's not about me at the moment. If you think I'm going to come up here and talk on the traditions right off the bat, you're mistaken. It's going to take me a couple of minutes to warm up. I just want to let you know that we're being taped. This is being taped tonight, and Glenn Kay will have tapes of this meeting downstairs afterwards, and as well as many others that you might have seen. The task that was given to me tonight was to talk on the subject, which is on page XIX in the foreword to the second edition. And it simply says at the end of the last paragraph, "Today, the remarkable unity of AA is one of the greatest assets that our society has." The remarkable unity of this fellowship is one of the greatest assets that we have. And I've been sober 5.5 years. And when I first started coming to the meetings, I went to all kinds of meetings. I heard all kinds of stuff. I heard a lot of good stuff. It made me stay. It made me stay because I identified. I identified with people I didn't know. Maybe I didn't even like them. It didn't matter because I had my own judgments. But the key thing is that when they spoke for the first time in my life, that person knew how I felt. Okay, and that's the great gift, is that identification. That's what kept me coming to AA. It wasn't a therapy meeting. It was with people that knew what they were talking about. You know, we shared something that was really, really important. It was important to me, which is why I'm here tonight. I'm here tonight because I don't want to die. It's that simple. You know, the steps talk about having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps. You know, we try to carry this message and practice these principles in all our affairs. It took me a while to grasp that the meaning of that step. And I could only do it through pain and suffering. It was nothing more than that. It was, I didn't want to go back. I had to go forward. And I knew that AA was the answer. I also knew that AA was the place. That was it. There was really nothing beyond this fellowship. And I knew that deep down in my heart. So luckily for me, I truly believed God did for me what I could not do for myself. He intervened. He put people in my life that didn't have certain fear. They were really cool to talk about the solution of Alcoholics Anonymous, which is you got to get a spiritual awakening or you're going to suffer and or die, you know? So that's what I did, and I found the solution in the program of action, which we affectionately call the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And having done that, by studying with another man the steps and doing the actions required, I got really interested for once in my life, and I never cared about history. All right, I'm more of a sort of financial anecdotal guy. I didn't care at all about history all throughout studying at college, et cetera, et cetera. And somebody gave to me in one of my first meetings, AA Comes of Age. Which actually, I got that book before I got the big book. And I remember reading in it, and I remember reading Bill's story, which is a little different than it is in the big book. And Bill talked about how his last drunk, when he goes golfing in Staten Island, how he came back in a blackout. He passed out on the brownstone steps in Brooklyn, and yet he still had the golf bag strap on his shoulder. And when I read that, I was like, that man is an alcoholic, you know? I mean, that I just identified with that. But the point I'm trying to make is I had gratitude for the first time, you know, a really strong sense of gratitude. And I was like, okay, how in God's name did all of this come together? You know, why are we here? You know, what's going on? And so I started, you know, researching the history because I was really interested. Anyway, when it comes down to this remark, the remarkable unity of AA is one of the greatest assets that our society has, how do we maintain this unity? And the answer to that is through our singleness of purpose, okay? And this is where the traditions really come into play. When I first came in, all I wanted was love, and I wanted people's attention, and that's what I got. I didn't really understand or care about the steps, and it wasn't until I had a spiritual awakening and got into the readings that I began to understand that there are rules in AA that are really important that hold us together. Because if we're not held together, then I'm going to die. I mean, that's just the understanding and awakening I've had that's come to me, especially in the first step. I'm powerless over alcohol, that my life has become unmanageable. Powerless because of the spiritual malady, the obsession and the allergy, and left to my own devices, I am a person that will lose all again, or my scorecard has read zero, which is an affectionate way of saying that I can be a loser again, okay? So I look into the traditions for our singleness of purpose, and in our first tradition, it says our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. And it always comes back to it's we, it's not an I program, okay? And that if I start putting my personal agendas or problems ahead of the group and the solution, then what I'm doing is I'm taking away from the solution to the alcoholic who still suffers. You see, left to my own devices, selfishness and self-centeredness is the root of my problem. So I come in and my ego says, listen to me, this is what I've got to say. Okay? And I don't necessarily care. And I'm talking about in the context of a meeting. I may not necessarily care about anybody else because I'm an alcoholic, I'm stuck in self. If I'm not sharing the solution, then people who have not had a spiritual awakening or are newcomers or don't know anything about our fellowship are going to get the wrong impression. And it's a very fine line that I ride when I decide to share off the solution. What can I do to place the welfare of AA ahead of my own? Well, very simply, in an AA meeting, I identify myself as an alcoholic. Okay, it's Alcoholics Anonymous, and therefore, it's for alcoholics. My sharing is based on my experience, my strength, and my hope. And in that context, as the Big Book says, you know, trust God, clean house, help other alcoholics. You know, the cleaning the house part especially, you know, steps 1 to 9. And then my hope, hoping that I can carry this message and still work with others as time moves on. One of the most important things, and that's something that we try to stress in our group, this is back to the theme of what I'm talking about. Am I talking about the solution? It's very important for me. Has anyone in here ever had a fight with their boss and the boss isn't even present? I need to talk about my problems, okay? I got a lot of them, all right? They just don't magically go away because I'm connected to God and I work with other guys. The time for me to do this, though, is with my sponsor on the phone, in person, before and after the meeting. In the meeting, though, it's, again, I go back to my experience, my strength, and my hope. And that's the most effective way to carry the message within the meeting. In regards to the second tradition, the singleness of purpose, this is one of those traditions that I could kind of understand really easily because it was all about God. And you know, it was really easy. I like the ones that are easy. I don't have to think a lot about. It's not about me, okay? One of the great reasons why we have business meetings is so everybody can partake in deep democracy, you know? The real voting gets place. And one of the best places I've learned about our fellowship and the vagaries of alcoholism, and when I see it in others, those control issues and those judgments are in the business meetings. And all the guys that I work with, I always tell them, listen, you want to learn about what's going on? You go to your business meeting. Because that's where we really can unravel, but at the same time, we come together and we vote. And we believe God speaks through us in those meetings. And where the vote sways is where God is moving us. So very, very important. In regards to the third tradition, and I'll close with this one, the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. That's very true. If I am not an alcoholic and I'm another sort of addict, I can have a desire to not drink, but if I haven't been drinking, then I don't meet the requirements because I won't have a desire to not drink the drinking that I haven't been doing. Does that make sense to anybody? In other words, it basically goes back to the selfishness and self-centeredness is the root of our problem. The identification that I talked about, all right? In the long form of this tradition, it talks about suffering from alcoholism, okay? Alcoholism, the threefold disease, spiritual, mental, and physical, all right? If you have those three things, and through identification, I can share with you that problem that brought me here and the solution of how I've recovered, okay? But yet I can still, get off the beam, so to speak, then chances are you are an alcoholic, and that's up to you to identify. It's not up for me to make that judgment. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety, okay? That's a great thing. I can only do this by sharing my experience, strength, and hope. And the only way that someone, at least the only way that I could ever begin to stay in these rooms was the pain being so great that I had to, be forced into the work, have a spiritual awakening, and give that back. And in regards to that third tradition, that's all I'm going to say. Thank you very much.
That was great. Everybody, I'm David, I'm an alcoholic. we all have our stories. Everybody's story is precious. My story in September 2001 was I just sold my apartment, and everything I owned was in a truck under the Trade Center. So I had no place to live. My job was a block away, and then everything happened, right? And I was with another recovering alcoholic on business in San Francisco, except this particular one didn't make meetings. So when everything went bluey, he locked himself up with the Sisters of Babylon for a week, and I ran to an AA meeting. And I met a guy there. You want to know what kind of program you got. Have everything taken out of your life and then turn the phone off, and then you'll find out who your higher power is. I was a big step guy, big book guy, but when the phones went black on me and I had nobody in the world that I knew, I mean, think about that, nobody. And I had nothing. My job was gone. Everything was gone. Nothing. I've been separated from the power, and I wasn't quite as connected as I like to think I was, right? So I met a guy who taught me that, sometimes it's better to see a sermon than to hear a sermon. And this guy became my friend, and he took me to meetings. And my luggage was on that airline, and it went down. I had no clothes. He put the word out. Everyday clothes started to show up at the hotel. I mean, I was safe and protected, position of neutrality all week long, and he did it with me one meeting at a time. And all he said to me is, I need help. Could you help me do this? Could you help me do that? And he loved me through AA for a week until I can get back to New York. We've been dear friends ever since, 7 years now. Tonight, to speak on strenuous work, one alcoholic with another is vital to permanent recovery. Please help me welcome Michael, who came from San Francisco to say hello to us. Come on up, Michael.
Thank you, David. Good evening. My name is Mike, and I'm an alcoholic. Happy anniversary, and happy anniversary to your group. 3 years. It's wonderful to be here and be present for this. Where I come from, it's customary to say three things. Well, I said four things, but that I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is April 5th, 1998. My home group is a meeting in a small town called Orinda. It's called the Orinda Group. It meets in Orinda at 8 o'clock. On Tuesday nights. And if any of you are in the Bay Area, you're welcome to come and attend. And if you let me know, I'd be happy to have you come and speak. And lastly, I have a sponsor. He's not here tonight, but I assure you, I do have a sponsor. He lives in San Francisco, and I sponsor others when I'm asked to. And I'd like to welcome any of the newcomers that are here tonight. Keep coming back. I hope if I don't have anything that you can relate to, just keep coming to meetings, and hopefully you'll hear something eventually that'll help you. I've found a lot of help here myself. Okay, I've been asked to speak, or I should say when I was presented with the line that strenuous work, one alcoholic working with another, is vital to permanent recovery, I had to scratch my head a little bit because when I was new in the program, my sponsor, when we read through the big book the first time, he made me stop at the first paragraph of the preface of the big book, and he said, you see where it says that this is the basic text of our society, of our program? He said, underline that word text, because a text is something that you're supposed to study. And he made me study the big book. And when I got this line, I was sure I was going to make sure to study in every way I could to try to get it across, you know. And I thought I'd heard it somewhere else in the book, you know, because, I mean, really, how often have you heard somebody at a meeting say, I have permanently recovered from alcoholism? I've never heard it. And if you'd asked me before I read this line here, I don't think I would have said, I don't think the big book ever says anywhere that we are permanently recovered from alcoholism. But there it is. So to make David proud, I scoured through the big book. And I looked for three important words. I mean, I'm a really sick alcoholic. That's why I'm here tonight and not at my home group. I'm here because it's David's anniversary and your group's anniversary, because I wanted to find these three words in the book. So I looked up permanent, I looked up vital, and I looked up strenuous. And I tell you what, they're not used that often. I think vital is probably the most cheaply used word in the first 164 pages. It's mentioned 9 times. I found it 9 times. You might find it more places, but I only found it 9 times. I found permanently used twice in the doctor's opinion. And I saw it used once in Bill's story, where he says that he mentions permanent brain damage. And lastly, strenuous, the word strenuous. I only found it used twice in the first 164 pages. Again, in Bill's story, where he says that our work, or an alcoholic in his cups is an unlived creature, and our escapades with them are comic and strenuous. And okay. And I found the word strenuous. This is really cool. I found the word strenuous, vital, and permanent used in the same sentence in an entirely different chapter. And I think I'll read it to you. This is the third anniversary of your group, and this is from the third step on page 64. And it has, when it says decision, it's referring to the third step decision. And remember, I was looking for three words: permanent, vital, strenuous. Though our decision was a vital and crucial step, it could have little permanent effect unless at once followed by a strenuous effort to face and be rid of the things in ourselves which had been blocking us. There you go. I found it, you know, so that's the most academic presentation I'm going to make on that line. Now I'd like to talk to you a little bit about what it means to me and how my sobriety has been affected by strenuous effort to work with other alcoholics. I was at a meeting this afternoon, and the topic was presented of this line in We Agnostics. It says, do not let any prejudice you have against spiritual terms deter you from honestly asking yourself what they mean to you. And I like to use that line, or at least the principle of that line, to think about other words like strenuous. What does it mean to be strenuous? I mean, I'm sure we could all go home tonight, look in a dictionary, and try to find out what does it mean to be strenuous. And we'd all have our own a definition that satisfies us. When I think of strenuous, I don't really go to the dictionary. I'll tell you something about myself. I really love to run. I love to do physical exercise, and I love to run. And I think in a lot of ways, running is kind of like staying sober. You know, there are days I wake up and I feel good. I am ready to go out and run. I want to go have a strenuous workout, and it's great. I love those days, just like great days when you're sober, you know. And I have days when I wake up and my legs are sore and it's cloudy and it's rainy and I don't want to go out there, and but I got to do it, you know, because I won't be happy with myself or satisfied unless I go out and do it, just like staying sober. Strenuous to me is when I'm working and I'm aware of it. You know, like if you go for a strenuous run, or at least when I go for a strenuous run and I start to feel the pain, I often ask myself, why did I do this again? You know, why am I doing this? You know, I'm in the middle of something. I'm 5 miles from home and I got to walk back? No way. That's going to take too long. I always ask myself, you know, how did I get myself into this again? That's when it's strenuous work. When I was new, my sponsor had me do one job. He had me make coffee at a beginner's meeting. It was a Monday night meeting. It met in a church a lot like this in the town where I got sober. The meeting place was actually probably more like the room downstairs. And the coffee pots were big. They were like the ones downstairs. The meeting started at 8 o'clock. And I had to get there early. I mean, like usually by 7 o'clock or maybe a little bit earlier because, you know, there are big pots and it takes a while for the coffee to percolate. Anyways, I had this brilliant idea. This is in my first 6 months. that if I could get there at 6 o'clock and set up real quick, I had the key, I could lock the door and go home and watch Monday Night Football for at least get to halftime. And then get back to the meeting hall, the coffee would be ready, and I could open up, and everybody would be happy, right? And nobody would know. There was a little old man who came to this meeting who set up the chairs. He was set up, I was coffee. This is one of those people, or he was one of those people in the program that was at a lot of meetings. He always stood in the back, he always sat in the back, and he didn't talk very much. You know, he was around. He was a regular, but nobody really knew him that much, or that well, I should say. I remember that I started doing this thing of showing up at 6 o'clock and then running home, and, you know, he actually caught on to this over a period of time, and he started showing up at 6 o'clock, too, and setting up the chairs while I was making the coffee. And I didn't want to leave the guy behind, you know, because, I felt kind of bad. The thing was, he was talking to me while he was setting up the chairs. And he was talking to me while I was making the coffee. And he had been going through a lot of problems at that time with his wife and health problems and whatnot. And again, this is somebody who doesn't speak in meetings. And I remember, wanting to go home and watch football, but at the same time realizing, you know what, I can't leave this guy. You know, he's talking to me. It would be rude of me just to walk away from him. And it happened for a couple weeks in a row, and finally I called my sponsor one night and I said, this guy, he has a sponsor. He told me that he has a sponsor. And I have to sit there and listen to him for like an hour and a half before anybody else shows up. And my sponsor said something to me I hope I never forget. He said, "What makes you think I want to listen to you whenever you call me?" And I learned a great lesson that day. You know, I can tell you a lot about working, my experience trying to help newcomers, trying to thrust a book in their hand or give them my experience. You know, I learned so much from that little old man, and I didn't like it, all right? It might have been strenuous for a while, but I learned to appreciate the value of just sitting there, being tolerant, and I don't know what happened to him. I haven't stayed in touch with him. I think he's dead, to be honest with you. Chikali died one day. He was in bad health. But I remember that every time I'm at a meeting and somebody's going on and on, and I don't want to listen, and it's strenuous. You know, it's strenuous for me to sit there and listen to it. You know, someday I might be one of those people that has to talk to somebody, and there may be nobody else around who wants to listen to me. I should at least try to listen to others. You know, that was strenuous for me, but, there have been times when I've worked with other alcoholics, and I've loved it. It's been like, I think my time is up. But I just want to get that across to you. Thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity to be here today, and happy anniversary to your group.
Hey everybody, I'm David. I'm an alcoholic. All right. So I got a sponsor too. And I got a home group too. So there. My sponsor's little words for big complicated people told me a couple things. Most insane thing I can ever do is stop trying. The other thing, more important, is just, I get it now. It's all coming together. Is, what is love, David? And I would give him these long fancy, he said, it's too complicated for you. Unconditional acts of kindness, expecting nothing in return. Be good to be good. Don't want anything back, and watch how the universe will love you. And I said, well, it's like Yoda. Like, I don't get it. Unconditional acts of kindness, expecting nothing in return. And he's getting ready for the big home group in the sky. We had our goodbye meeting on Saturday, and he's getting ready. He's 90 years old. He had his third stroke and just got over the shingles, and he misses his wife. And he had us all together on Saturday night. And it was like I was the youngest guy in the room. I was 14 years sober. I was the baby. And it was just guys. Their next guy was like 35 years sober, 40 years sober, all sponsored by this guy. And they welcomed me. And it was kind of like the gathering of the pens and a beautiful mind, So I've been looking around, and I think I found the guy. The last topic that we're going to talk about tonight, is... something I've had some small experience with lately. It's from page 15 of our book, and it is the deal closer in AA. It sets the hook. It's what brings the bees to the honey. The joy of living we really have, even under pressure and difficulty. And let us find out how that happens. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome my friend Chris S. from the Bernersville Group in New Jersey.
Good evening, everybody. My name's Chris. I am an alcoholic. It's great to be here tonight. I've been to this group a number of times, and I always find it to be very enthusiastic. There's people here that are really paying attention. The topic tonight is, for me, is the joy of living. I personally have a lot of experience with that. I've also got experience on the flip side of that, which was the incredibly painful struggle of maintaining an active alcoholic lifestyle. I know that there are people in this room that know exactly what I'm talking about. It was a struggle. I think from somewhere around my first year of drinking, it became an ordeal. And because I was alcoholic, I got caught up in it. And I always drank differently than the people that I was around. It caused me a lot more trouble than it caused them. It seemed like I had a relationship with alcohol that other people didn't have. I was always more concerned about when we were going to get it, you know, how are we going to get it, is there going to be enough? And there just didn't seem to be that level of intensity with other people and their relationship with alcohol. I it was different. And from that moment on, it caused, alcoholism caused a great struggle in my life. And even the times when I really thought I was having a good time, there was always problems. There was always the price to pay the next day. There was always the damage that it was doing to my self-esteem. You know, you may not have crashed 9 cars like me. You may not have had 3 DWIs. You may not have lost your family. You may not have had 13 jobs in the last 10 years. You know, you may not have been killed in accidents and then got better because somebody actually gave you CPR. There's a lot of things that I've got experience with that you may not have. So what I'd like to talk about is the things that we have in common. The spiritual malady. My spiritual malady manifested at a very young age. It manifested as an anxiety. I was uncomfortable with myself. I was uncomfortable with my environment. I remember this from kindergarten. I just didn't feel like I thought everybody else. I was looking around, the kids are just, they're having a blast. None of them have any repressed, emotional anxiety. And I'm like, just freaked and just trying not to show it. And I spent an entire childhood that way, afraid to talk about the things that were going on with me, afraid to show any weakness, very, very concerned with what you thought about me. I was always judging my actions on what I thought you were going to think about me. And this is what I understand today, part of the spiritual malady of alcoholism. The only reason I know it's part of the spiritual malady is the solution to alcoholism cured this for me, or better word, treated this condition for me. And when I got through the recovery process, I no longer had that anxiety. I no longer was so attached to what you thought about me that I was, basing all my life decisions on how I was going to look. Some other things that I suffered from early on with alcoholism was self-centered fear, which manifested as anxiety, that was near crippling at certain times. I also suffered from situational forms of depression. I would say something in a conversation and I would think, oh my God, I can't believe I said that. And for like 3 days, I would worry about how I looked because I had said something stupid. And I would feel really, really depressed about it. I would work myself over for the smallest things. And I got to tell you, it certainly didn't look like the people I was hanging out with were operating that way. They seemed to be just fine saying something stupid and moving on. Now, I also never felt comfortable where I was doing what I was doing. There always had to be somewhere else or some other people or, you know, if I just feel like I got to get out of here. You know, I heard a speaker one time say he was backstage with the Beatles and he was thinking, I can't wait to get out of here, you know, and go somewhere. You know, like that really, I could have been in the best place in the world, but I gotta go. So I suffered a lot from that. I was restless. I was irritable. I was discontented. I was very acutely aware of any slight that you might make toward me. If you insulted me, or I thought you insulted me, or if something didn't go my way, or I thought I was being cheated, this was a calamity that would take up my thinking life for weeks and weeks and weeks. And, you know, the normal scuttlefish I was going to school with didn't seem to, you know, have those kinds of problems, but I need to straighten this out, you know, I'm gonna get them! So I suffered from these resentments for literally decades. You know, I mean, when I first got sober, there were kids that were 5 years old when they harmed me that I still wanted to get. You know, the internet was just coming out, I'll find them, you know. I mean, this is part of the way the spiritual malady manifested in my life. I just was not right. I was not comfortable. I couldn't step out easy until I found alcohol. Alcohol, for a period of time, offered me freedom from this spiritual malady. The bondage of self, they talk about in the book Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was in bond. You might as well have put me in a prison because I was anything but free. I was always trapped with this emotional negativity and pain. All of a sudden, I drank half a bottle of Four Roses whiskey, and guess what? I knew a new freedom and a new happiness. I was no longer concerned about what you thought about me. All right, I felt like I was the funniest, coolest person in that room, okay? And you were lucky to be hanging out with me. It was a complete shift in perception. It was a complete shift in my perspective on life. There was so much in that bottle of whiskey that there wasn't for the two guys I was drinking with. The two guys I was drinking with just, you know, felt a little bit lightheaded, maybe a little queasy, and said to themselves, you know, I've had enough. Let's just watch the show with Chris. Because I drank like the whole bottle and just went crazy. Now that was like an anti-Chris potion. You know, I could get out of myself. I could finally feel like I thought all of you felt all the time. I really thought there was something wrong with me. And that this alcohol cured what was wrong with me. And I started to become preoccupied with the alcohol. I started to figure out when I could use it, you know, who was going to buy it. It became a big preoccupation in my life because I needed it, okay? So I do a lot of working with other alcoholics. We were on a wet drunk 12-step call last night. I mean, you know, we're busy about the Father's business with other alcoholics, my wife and I. We are. And I see this time and time and time again, and it's inherent in the illness, alcoholism, is an utter inability to have a true perspective about how much trouble you're really in and how negative the effect of alcoholism is on your life. You just kind of paint a picture of like, well, this is the way life is for me, you know. Life sucks and then you die. You know, you have this like really bad, bad perspective because you don't know anything different. Alcoholism creeps up on you usually very, very slowly, and your perspective and perception on life just gets darker and darker and darker over the months and years. And you wake up, you know, you wake up at a point in time where you're near suicidal. You show every form of psychological disorder toward the end. You know, if you walked into a psychiatrist, you'd have everything, you know, feeling the way that we do toward the end of our drinking. You'd present every dysfunctional psychological and psychiatric disorder there is. But it happens slowly over the course of time. So you don't really know that you're in bondage. You don't really know that you're trapped in alcoholism. You can't see how much trouble you're really in. Alcoholism doesn't allow that for you. So if you're anything like me or most of the guys I sponsor, you minimize. You know, yeah, I'm dying. You know, my liver's popping out. I had 36 DWIs. You know, tried to shoot my family. How many meetings you want me to go to every week? My God, that's a lot. You know, we minimize where it concerns our recovery process because we just don't have the ability to see just how bad it is. Now, if you're lucky enough to get placed in front of a sponsor or a spiritual advisor who has had a vital spiritual awakening through the course of action laid out in the book Alcoholics Anonymous, The 12 Steps, if you're lucky enough to be exposed to such a person and somehow you can summon up the enthusiasm and willpower to follow that direction without having something better to do, you know, if you're that lucky, you'll start to notice something. You'll start to see just how monstrous the illness alcoholism is because you'll start to recover from it. And that's the only way you can truly see how much trouble you were in is by recovering from it. Again, I knew I wasn't real happy with my life, you know, when I was out there drinking. But I had no idea the enormity of the problem until I started to recover from it. Because alcoholism is a progressive, fatal illness. Over any considerable period of time, it always gets worse. It never gets better. We can put it in remission with sobriety, and we can improve our quality of life through recovery. All right, but alcoholism is a monster. It is a powerful foe. But if you're lucky enough to get placed in front of someone who can guide you into the recovery part of alcoholism, you will start to recover from a lot of this emotional, spiritual, psychic pain that you're in. Because I look at alcoholism today. I don't look at alcoholism as, you know, I drink a lot or whatever. I look at alcoholism as a spiritual malady. One of the symptoms of alcoholism is drinking. Okay? It's a big symptom. It's an important warning sign, you know, if you're drinking three quarts a day. But more importantly to me today is that psychic, spiritual, emotional pain that we feel as alcoholics. You know, I really used to think that I was just different than everybody. I felt injustice more deeply than most people. And, you know, I had this dark, complicated personality. And, you know, I'm just a lot smarter than everybody else, you know. So that's the burden I have to, you know, that cross I have to carry. That was all crap. I'm like, you know, I'm dying of alcoholism. Now, I heard a statistic one time, alcoholics are 60 times more likely to commit suicide than non-alcoholics. Another important warning sign, if you know. You know, why do we do that? What could possibly be the correlation that would explain such a statistic? Has anybody in here ever felt that pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization that happens when you come to after one last bender? Anybody in here know the hideous four horsemen? Terror, frustration, bewilderment, despair. You know what I'm talking about. How about the loneliness of the alcohol? You've pushed everybody away because they're in the way of your drinking. You've pushed them away. They can't be a part of your life anymore because they call attention to your drinking. It could be your family. It could be your friends. They have to go. And you're not even making a conscious decision about this. You're just pushing them away. They have to go. How about the loneliness when you're at the end of your run and you're just wondering what is going on here? You know, where is it? Where are all the good people? Where have they gone? And you've pushed them away. How about that loneliness? Okay. How about the self-pity? Most of us are very, very competent individuals. You know, we can sometimes do more drunk than most of the people around us can do on 100% of their brain power. You know what I'm talking about, okay? And Al-Anons would probably disagree with me, you know? But the fact of the matter is we really are quite competent. We can do more with a blazing hangover than most people can do, feeling on top of the world. But we shoot ourselves in the foot. We have a lack of consistency. We can't seem to do a good, consistent job over the long haul. So we end up getting fired, or we end up quitting before they find us out, or we end up changing careers, or I'm going to do this because, you know, it just doesn't seem that important anymore to do that. And, you know, so we lack consistency, so it's very, very hard for us to build up a bright outlook for our family and keep it. You know, we'll build it up, but it'll get torn down through a series of senseless sprees. Now, these are some of the things that most, if not all of us, have in common, I think, as alcoholics. Now, the recovery process. Step one. I have to see as clearly as possible my truth about power, choice, and control with the addictive substance I'm involved with. If I'm an alcoholic, I need to see the truth about the relationship I have with alcohol. Do I have power, choice, and control over alcohol? Once I start drinking, do I have any control over where it takes me? And I have to look at the unmanageability. Am I having problems with my personal relationships? Am I prey to misery and depression? Can I control my emotional nature if I decide to? Can I be of real help to people? I have to look at the unmanageability, the internal unmanageability. I need to get clear on that. And once I'm clear on that, that's going to provide the power to move me through the rest of the steps. If you're not clear on the first step, you're going to leave stuff out of your fourth and fifth. You're not going to make all those amends. And you're going to have a real tough time working with other people. I'll say right here, right now, if you've been around a while and you're not sponsoring other people, you don't pray and meditate consistently, you have unfinished amends, and there are just some things you're never going to tell anybody, you don't have a first step. You can't tell anybody you've got a first step. Because the first step is, if I don't do these things, I'm going to die an alcoholic death. You may be choosing to die an alcoholic death. Some of us do. Live life along spiritual lines, choose an alcoholic death. Oh, man, that's a tough one. You know, we do that. It's insane, but we do it. So I've got the power from step one. I move into step two. Okay, I'm totally hosed. Step one, the time and the place is going to come. I'm going to drink again. I'm going to die. It's going to be horrible. There won't be any pallbearers at my funeral. I'm going to go out in disgrace. Okay, step one. Well, maybe not. You know, I can come to believe in the power that's generated through the recovery process in Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't even have to go to the God spot yet if I don't want to. You can obviously see that there's a power in this room that we don't have on our own unaided will when we're out there by ourselves. So I can engage in, alcoholism is my problem, spiritual living is my solution. I engage in spiritual living by coming in here. I can come to believe that if I start coming to Alcoholics Anonymous and I participate in the process, meetings, steps, and service, I can come to believe that I can be restored to sanity. I can recover from alcoholism. All right, if I've got the first two steps, the next logical step is step three. Make a decision to engage in that spiritual process. I need to engage in that. I need to participate in that spiritual process. There's a line I love in the step book. It's, God will not render us white as snow without our cooperation. How then shall I cooperate? to get placed in the sunlight of the Spirit where I can be safe and protected. The problems in my life can be removed. My character defects can be addressed. Where and how do I do that? I'm in, okay? So step three is basically, are you in or are you out? You know, you want to keep playing around on your own, you know, you work in your own program that got you three wristbands and the detoxes. You want to keep doing that? Or do you want to try what we're doing here? Okay, I'm in. All right, I've made the decision. You know, I'm not going to like what you tell me to do. I won't even think it's going to work for me because I'm different. I'm going to understand that it's a stupid exercise, but I've so run out of plans that, okay, I'll try it. And one of the reasons I'm trying it is so that when it doesn't work, I can tell you you're wrong. But I'll do it. Okay? I'm in. Sometimes your motives don't matter. Your actions matter very much in Alcoholics Anonymous. Okay, I'm in. Next step is to identify the causes and conditions of my failure at life. Because looking at my failure at life, looking at my character defects, looking at my defective relationships, that's looking at my alcoholism. Okay, you don't go head to head with alcohol. You don't just stop drinking it. You know, if you can do that, you're not an alcoholic. Okay, the Big Book is very, very clear on that. If you can just say, no more for me, thanks, I quit, you know, I don't do a lot of this stuff, I don't do a lot of these steps, I don't work with anybody, I go to a few meetings, but, you know, I don't pray and meditate, I never did a four step. If you can stay sober that way, you're not an alcoholic. You're what the Big Book describes as a heavy drinker. You're what the Step Book describes as a potential alcoholic, barely a potential alcoholic, whatever. Without a spiritual awakening, the alcoholic drinks. That's what we are. An alcoholic is someone who, when they make a decision not to drink, that means nothing. Okay? You're drunk anyway. Figuring that decision not to drink was kind of an overreaction, I guess. You know? Or however we paint the picture. But alcohol goes back in our body. Okay? So we need to look at our alcoholism. We need to look at our resentments. You know, why are we so pissed off all the time? Why do we take such offense? Why are we so sensitive about everything and everybody? And, you know, our family, and my boss is a jerk, and, you know, my friends, they just don't respect me. You know, we have to look at what the heck is going on with our personal relationships. Then we need to look at our fear. We need to look at our anxiety. We need to look at what is making us so uncomfortable. So uncomfortable with ourselves and our environment. We need to inventory that. And then we need to look at the people we've harmed. We need to look especially at the sexual relationships we've had because we have some buttes. You know what I'm saying? Okay? Holy mackerel. And we take hostages and we use sex as a weapon and you know, I mean, you know, it's just not what God planned for, you know, the sex act. Let me tell you. So we need to look at all this because our harms and our sex conduct is causing us guilt and shame and remorse and we're burdened with this. You know, we can't live with this. It's just oppressive. Like, you know, have you ever drive down a road and you think your mind wanders back to some horrible thing you did 10 years ago and you go like, oh, I mean, you want to be free. I mean, recovery is about freedom. We have to get past this stuff. So we have to honestly look at it. We have to take responsibility for it. We have to share this with somebody. There's 9 places in the Big Book where it highlights the fact that you can hold nothing back. Did you know that? There's 9 places in the Big Book that highlights the fact that if you hold anything back, you're going to probably drink. That's something that we sometimes as sponsors, we forget to point out to people these days. You have to be brutally honest with this stuff. Brutally honest with this stuff. Listen, if there's still statutes of limitations on some of your stuff and you got a flaky sponsor that you may not trust too much, then do it with a priest. It says person or persons we share this vital information with. Okay? So it can be multiple people. You can share your criminal stuff with somebody who legally can't be part of the prosecutorial team to come after you. You know, go ahead, but you gotta share it. All right. So fifth step, brutally honest. Now, If you could do anything about your character defects, wouldn't you have done a better job now? By now, okay? Wouldn't you? Have you ever said, I'm not going to be so selfish anymore? Give me that, you know? I mean, right away, you have as much power over your character defects as you had power over when you put alcohol in your body or how much you took after you started drinking. All right, I'm not one of these people that think that I can read a self-help book and, you know, practice giving of yourself. Yeah, I mean, I'd do it for about 5 minutes and then I'd be right back to being a complete horse's ass. We become willing to have God remove these defects of character. Character defects are alcoholism. We become willing to have God remove our alcoholism, which is our character defects, which is all of these spiritual, emotional, and psychic problems that we have. We become willing that God would remove those. But remember, there's a participation in there. God will not render us white as snow without our participation. Then how shall we participate? First thing we do is we ask God, humbly, on our knees, ask God to remove these defects of character, holding nothing back. That was the original manuscript version of the steps. And that's how Dr. Bob did it. He'd make you get down on your knees, young fella. You know, say it again. Put some feeling into it this time. I mean, and really, with humility. The humility that we need is the same type of humility we ask for our help from alcoholism. We need to be so humble. Look, I am done. These character defects are causing me and everyone I love constant pain. Please take them. Please take them so that I can be better use to you and your other children. Please take these. I surrender. You know, you got to go with that kind of humility. And that leads you into making a list of the people you have harmed. Okay? Make a list of the complete list of the people you had harmed. Here's where you're not allowed to edit. Well, if I put that guy down, I'll have to go make an amends to him, and I'm not gonna ever talk to that guy. Yeah, you know what he did to me? Just put everybody down. The spiritual exercise of step 8 is a separate exercise than step 9. Just do the spiritual exercise of step 8 and put everybody down that you've hurt. Okay? Then comes step 9. Become willing to make amends to these people or institutions, except where to do so would injure them or others. You want to put muscle in your sobriety. You want to put strength in your recovery. Nothing so much makes your recovery or your freedom from this emotional bondage more possible than a real attack on step 9. A real demonstration of making as many amends as you possibly can make, except when to do so would injure them or others. If you got to fly to Albuquerque, then get your ticket. You know? Too bad it's inconvenient. How free do you want to be? Do you want to be free? Do you want to be able to walk down the road and have not a person on this planet have a problem with you? Now, I don't know about you. I was afraid to walk up the street where I lived to go to the liquor store because I don't know what I did in blackouts to these neighbors. You know, I'd park on their lawns or, you know, I'd have some problem with them and threaten their life in a blackout and then forget the next day and walk right by them, you know. I mean, I had to straighten out a lot of stuff. I had to pay a lot of money back. I had to make a lot of phone calls. I had to do a lot of things, all right? That put an incredible amount of strength in my recovery. That moved me from restless, irritable, discontented to happy, joyous, and free. Basically, that one experience of completing amends. You ever see somebody that's completed amends? Get them behind a podium. You know, if they've just done as many amends as they can possibly do, put them behind a podium because God's speaking through their mouth. You know what I mean? I want to hear from them. I don't care if they've got a week. I don't care if they've got 10 years. I want to hear from them if they've had that experience. Because recovery is an experience. It's not an intellectual exercise. You don't learn about sobriety. You experience it. And if you're not doing the steps, you don't know what recovery is. I'm sorry. You just don't. Because it's an experience that you have. It's not something that you learn through reading the books. Now, you've made your amends. You've learned a lot of lessons about how to live. I believe step 10 is my walking around during the day step. I think it's my reactive step. I can take all of the tools that I've learned in 1 through 9, and I can take the tools of 11 and 12, if I've been through the steps before, and I can use them as an operational methodology. If I do something stupid, I can make amends for it. All right. If something's really bothering me, I can share it with another person, ask God to take away the character defects and go make amends. I can use these things reactively to stop the emotional, spiritual, and psychic buildup. Those feelings that make us uncomfortable and really impact our quality of life. I have a toolkit that can address that and keep me in the sunlight of the Spirit, safe and protected, happy, joyous, and free. I just need to start learning it. The spiritual life is a discipline, and we as alcoholics don't like to hear the term discipline. You know, we think like military. We think all kinds of things when we hear the term discipline. But to develop a program, you must learn some discipline. All right, I'm using that as an operational methodology, the other steps. And some of the other spiritual principles found in AA. I need to now seek through prayer and meditation to get myself closer to that or who, which is keeping me safe and protected, and removing my character defects. I need to get close to that power. There's a power much greater than me that I now have an experience with because I've done the first 10 steps. There's no more maybe there's a God. I don't believe there's a God. Now I know there's a God because I've had a spiritual awakening. I've had a spiritual experience. Now I need to continue to grow. I need to continue to deepen my relationship with God. I need to learn how to get to that intuitive part of my nature that allows me to know right from wrong. Intuition is basically knowing without conscious thought. If I can get to that intuitive nature, that sixth sense, that fourth dimension of reality, if I can start to live with an access to that intuition, I can stop making mistakes in my life. If I start to listen to that intuitive part of my nature, good things start to happen. You start doing esteemable things and you start building up self-esteem. You start doing positive things start happening in your life. You start getting promotions. You start hanging out with better people. All kinds of better things happen when you start to develop that intuitive piece of your nature. And I believe that's what step 11 is about. That's what my experience is with it. Now, all of this is preparation for the real work of Alcoholics Anonymous, which is helping other alcoholics. If you've done the first 11 steps, I don't have to worry about you helping others. The only people that don't go around sponsoring or offering their hand or trying to be of service are the people who haven't experienced step 1 through 11. The people who've experienced step 1 through 11 are actively trying to pass on the experience that they've had, because that's the evolution of a spiritual awakening. You want to pass this on. You'll realize that your quality of life, your recovery is going to hinge on continuing to practice a compassionate lifestyle. A compassionate lifestyle. Trying to ease suffering in the universe. And we start with alcoholics, and sometimes we branch off into other areas. But we need to turn our life into a life of service. Here's the shift. Here's the spiritual awakening shift. A life perspective based on self-centered fear. It's always about us, okay? The shift in perception goes from a life system based in fear to a life system based in love and service. That really is the spiritual awakening. If you had a spiritual awakening, you're about the business of love and service. Love and service brings us to a state of consciousness where we are happy, joyous, and free. You look at anybody truly, truly okay with themselves and really, really spiritually centered, and they're working with other people somehow. Somehow they're giving back more than they're taking. And that's a key. And you know what? We go from a selfish, self-centered, self-seeking alcoholic to somebody who can't do enough for other people. And by going from there to here, we get to a place not only where we're happy, joyous, and free, but we absolutely insist upon enjoying life. We know a new freedom and a new happiness. You know how many promises are in the big book? You know, check them out sometime. Next time you read the big book, number them. There's, depending on how you interpret the promises, there's like 200-some promises in there. Okay? Some of the great ones are, some of the great promises is, the most enjoyable days that you'll know are ahead of you. Okay? Frequent contact with newcomers will be the joy of your life. If you just walked into your first AA meeting tonight, you're going to wonder about that one. But I'm telling you, it is for me. Now, the question that they pose in the book Alcoholics Anonymous is, do you want to hold on to your old ideas? Do you want to continue to have your interpretation of everything? Or do you want to be open to something that's going to bring you an incredible amount of happiness? Do you want to be right or do you want to be happy? Okay, that's a question we all need to ask. I want to thank David and the group for having me here tonight. It's been a blast. I hope to come back sometime. Thanks a lot.